Welcome to the latest episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast with data protection people. My name is Ollie Rear and I'm the host of these sessions. But I'm not on my own. This week I'm joined for the purposes of this intro by Mr. David Holmes.
Hi,
David.
Welcome.
It's your first time doing one of these intros.
First time with the Christmas hat on. Yeah.
First time for everything. Good session this week, I thought. That was good
fun. It's interesting bits around the privacy elements from the Duchess to Google. Would be fair to say.
Yes. Yeah. Did you just come up with that off the top of your head?
That's it, yeah.
It's not bad. You can come again. Good session this week. Very enjoyable. It's just a GDPR radio, so we talked about all sorts, didn't we? Really,
they're really fun sessions, aren't they? Because you kind of just try to start out with some kind of plan of where we're going to go and stuff, and then you get interactions from people online on the session with us. Phil will say something different. We'll kind of raise something different, and we'll have a plan. We just kind of throw it out the window and kind of just have a chat about anything that kind of arises. So I think they're pretty fun things.
Really good. So we hope you enjoy the session. From a news perspective, we are back next week with a bumper session for the healthcare sector, organised by our very own Temi, her first event. So we're very excited about that. We've got some excellent guest speakers lined up. Plenty of information coming out about that over the course of the week. If you want an invite, just reach out to the usual channels, give us a shout, and sure, you can come along. Definitely recommend, particularly if you're in healthcare, but even if you're not, you know, could still be interesting. It's always good to get a read on other sectors. Otherwise, in other news, very exciting, the new DPP website is going live, I think, imminently, by the looks of it. So go check that out. We're really, really excited to show you all that. Plenty of fun things to go see and do and play with on there. So do go and have a look. But in the meantime, I hope you enjoy this episode. Dave, any disclaimers before we get stuck in?
No, I think it's a really fun session. I think it moves across quite a lot of things. And for anybody who has seen it visually or if Miles put any pictures online, I do apologise about the hat.
Yeah. For the listeners, that's not going to make any sense, but Dave's wearing a Christmas hat and it's really disconcerting. So without further ado, I will leave you in the very capable hands of Mr. Phil Brining remotely, but also David Holmes and Toph. And on that note, good afternoon, everyone. I hope you're all well. Welcome to this latest episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast with myself, Ollie Rose, your host, joined this week live and direct in the flesh by Mr. David Holmes.
Hi, welcome everybody, and anybody who joined us last week will appreciate why I'm handing the mantle back over to Ollie. So good to have you back, Ollie.
Good to be back. And it wouldn't be an episode of GDPR Radio without our very own Mr. Phil Brining. Hello, Phil.
Hello, Ollie.
Unfortunately, not live and direct, on the way down shortly, I believe. But we've still got you on the call, so that's the main thing. So a few bits of admin before we get stuck in. If you're new to these sessions, well, first of all, welcome. We hope you enjoy it. And if you're new, just a few bits and pieces to work through, one of which is that these are very, very informal sessions, as you can probably already tell by how we've gotten underway. Extremely informal. And with that comes the idea that it's always better if you get involved. So people on the call, please do drop in any comments, questions, queries, anything at all. If you pop them in the chat, I'm keeping an eye on that right here. If not, just unmute and dive in, get stuck in. What you will realize if you're new is that we have a tremendous propensity to rabbit on. So you do sort of need to barge in, quite frankly, if you've got something to contribute. Yeah,
absolutely. Please do mute and please do join in when you can.
Yeah, by all means. We do like to record these sessions and put them out in the form of a podcast afterwards, the Data Protection Made Easy podcast. There was a privacy notice relating to that on screen just a second ago. I'm sure Joe can put it back up again. But if you've got any issues with that at all, obviously just let us know. I don't think we've got any other admin to get through as far as I'm aware. So I suggest that we get stuck in. Now, I've got a couple of items on my list for this week. Dave and I were frantically trying to prepare some things to talk about off air, But first of all, Phil, have you got anything that you wanted to discuss in particular this week?
I got three or four things, Ollie, one of which was that video I mentioned earlier, which I just put a link to it in the chat. Again, quite interesting, you know, an hour, 55 minutes long, just having a skim through. You can skim through it and get the gist of it. But basically, there's Microsoft and Lindsay Tonsiger, partner from a law firm. They're talking about, you know, the complexity of trying to build a global privacy approach for a company like Microsoft. And I'm raising it because I don't know how relevant it is to most of our clients, but certainly relevant to the work you've been doing. And it's just, again, quite good to just consider what the differences are, you know, quite significant differences in the approach of some of the law that's evolving. We were talking earlier in the week about the Abu Dhabi law, which I think comes into effect next week. It was enacted
very shortly, yeah.
Yeah, and again, if you've got, because we do work with multinational corporations, and you know we have helped to try to build an overall global approach, but you know it's impossible in some respects because of the differences in some of these laws. And again, this video is just quite interesting to have a scan through as privacy professionals, just to you know to kind of remind ourselves of those things. Really, that was
no absolutely.
A couple of other things. I was having a look at the certification schemes. There's three certification schemes on the ICO's website, and I downloaded them all and I started reading through the criteria and the background and the structure. And I mean, I really like them actually. There's Age Check, the Age Appropriate Design Code of Practice, and an Asset Recovery certification scheme. So these are different to codes of conduct, which we're working on within the housing sector. These are certification schemes. Again, we could talk about that if you want later on. And then the ICO's opinion on ad tech was released last week, 25th, which again is interesting because they're setting out the ICO's expectations. Kind of linked to that is the Clearview AI, which I think we should talk about as well, where it's a joint op between the ICO and the Australian Privacy Regulator Commissioner. Because that looks like it might be quite a big chunky fine.
No, that's very much on the list to discuss. Sorry, I'm fiddling with this console and I shouldn't be. No, that's definitely on the list to discuss. So we'll get to that in due course. I think you mentioned there in relation to the piece of work that I've been doing. I've been doing a lot of work. So for your benefit, Dave, actually, we've not even spoken about this. One of my clients recently was bought out by parent company abroad in Australia, so they're a UK company, and now their parent company is looking to start bringing some of their products to the UK. So they've asked me to do some work and try and prepare them for the UK market on that front. But it's quite interesting, you know, kicking around the extraterritorial provisions of the UK GDPR and how that works. So talking about what comes under Article 3, and then also the representatives requirement in theory is also quite an interesting thing to consider. And one of the things I was just picking Phil's brain about earlier in the week, because you were otherwise engaged, was around appointing a DPO for effectively a foreign company. Because currently I'm the DPO for this client, and it's whether it would make sense, whether it would be acceptable to make sense for that DPO position to continue out of the UK, but also cover, you know, extraterritorial jurisdiction. So it's quite interesting. There's a lot to talk about in it.
I seem to have lost your video feed, Ollie, but carry on and see if you can. Maybe you pushed the wrong button.
I hope not. I've definitely stopped fiddling, so hopefully we come back very shortly. But yeah, so that's what Phil's referring to there and what I've been working on. Before we get on to bits like the Clearview AI story, is there anything from the working week, Dave, that you wanted to raise at this juncture?
No, not really from my working week. I've been tied up with 27001 for the last, well, Monday to Wednesday was 27001 with a client. They're going through a surveillance audit. The annual surveillance audit next year is going to be the reset. They managed to retain their certification, which is good. But it's just interesting to see different styles, different standards, different auditing methods to the standard that's in place. I've been heavily involved with that this week.
Oh, excellent. No, it is always interesting to get, you know, involved in that sort of thing. And I suppose, as you say, sort of see the other side of the coin almost.
From being interviewed, not being the interviewer.
Quite. So I guess there's no point sort of being around the bush, so to speak. I suppose we should probably talk about this ClearView AI find then, Phil. So would you like to fill us in on that? Because I have to admit, I've not been as close to it as I probably should have been.
Well, I mean, there's not an awful lot to it in a way. So there was a joint operation between the Australian Privacy Commissioner and the ICO. And I mean, what's interesting really is just reading through what ClearView AI have been doing. So they've been using a facial recognition tool to basically put an algorithm across images, but they've scraped all those images off the internet. So, you know, your LinkedIn profile, your picture on your website, you know, there's a I would have thought an exceedingly high chance that this tool, which has been a web crawler, has been collecting images of individuals' faces from publicly available sources right across the internet, including social media. And these images have all been scraped and metadata added to them, and then created a vector was created of those images using sort of mathematical representation. Now, if you are objected to this, then they basically again say, well, we'll take you have to supply an email address and an image of yourself, and they'll vectorize that image and retain it indefinitely, and then they will try and search their database to see if there's any images of you with a matching mathematical representation. So that's what they've been doing. And obviously, you know, the privacy regulators are saying, well, that's not fair. It's not transparent. It's not lawful. It's, there's also lots of question marks around their opt-out request approach. Right. In different countries, there's different methods of opting out. What was interesting is there's a memorandum of understanding between the ICO and the Australian Information Commissioner. That's been a joint investigation, but it's just that this has been obviously going on for some time and it's kind of come to light, and they've been instructed to stop doing that, destroy all the images. So, this is to stop now and destroy powers that the ICO has got. Sorry, someone's...
As part of that, did they actually look at the accuracy of the facial mathematics, as it were? Any accuracy?
I don't know, if I'm being honest. I don't know that it goes into that level of detail as to how accurate those mathematical representations are and whether the opt-out actually works, because, you know, if you've got, you know, long hair or short hair or grey hair, I don't know. I don't know. But, I mean, these things are pretty good, aren't they, mathematically representing variations, because it pinpoints.
So, the only reason why I say that is because mathematically I do look exactly like my twin, and if there's pictures of me on Facebook, it will tag my brother, not me, which is a bit awkward at times when the wife says, "We look, I'm on holiday," and it tags my brother instead of me. That could cause a few confusions, but mathematically, according to Facebook's algorithm, myself and the twin look the same.
I didn't know you had a twin.
Have you? I think he's making it up.
I think he is.
Facebook. Not sure, Dave. Why don't you raise an objection with ClearView and see what happens?
Get sorted out.
I tell you another thing, Ollie.
They might say after a £17 million potential fine, they've already scrubbed it, so the objection might not go very far.
Yeah. I tell you another thing, so diving off down a tangent, I was doing my expenses yesterday or the day before, and I was wanting to get all the things I bought off eBay, and there's just no way of generating a purchases report, a report of purchases. You'd think that you could output a list of all the purchases, wouldn't you, over a period of time? You can view them on the screen, but there's no way of running a report. So I raised a question with the chat bot, and they basically said, oh, click on this link and ask for the report, and it'll be forthcoming. And it was a link to a subject action request site. And it's really, I took a screenshot of it. It was so good, really well structured, you know, broken down all the different types of data that eBay have got, and you can tick different boxes. And it must be a really slick automated process in the back. I mean, they have a relatively limited business model, don't they, I suppose, from a consumer point of view. But I was surprised I got routed to a SAR site. I was impressed with it when I saw it.
Yeah, I would have thought it would it necessarily count as a...
Yeah, it's business as usual, transactional stuff.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah, absolutely.
I find it strange that they don't have that sort of built in by default, and that they are effectively outsourcing that to their SaaS function or their subject rights function.
Yeah,
self-service model.
Self-service model. So yeah. That was interesting, though. It's always great, I think, when you come across these things sort of in the wild. Ferreting around, as Phil says, trying to export your purchase and go, oh, that's quite good. I know you've got an extensive collection of privacy notices, haven't you, Phil?
I have, yes.
Found
one of my hobbies is collecting them. I never see one. And I've walked miles, and I've driven miles behind vehicles to try and see when they stop, and then I can get a picture of the video camera on board type privacy notice. So, yes, it's one of those things I do from time to time.
I
think you've been caught, Phil, so I passed a van the other day in Leeds that says this vehicle's followed by Phil.
Well, okay, so that's the Clearview AI stuff. I don't know if there's anything that you wanted to say, Dave, on it.
Carry on.
No, I was just making sure that we covered that fully. I don't know if there's anything else.
I'd seen the headlines for the AI thing. I didn't delve into it. The one that what most people have probably seen on the news recently is the with the Duchess of Sussex case against the Associated Newspapers. In that sense, I don't know if anybody else caught that as well in the news.
Yeah.
It's interesting to read that it's kind of a mix between the standoff between privacy and freedom of speech.
Yeah, so it's effectively in the vein of what Campbell, isn't it? Campbell and MDN and all those cases. So it's, I guess, a development again of, well, or maybe not a development, but a reinforcement of that doctrine, which is interesting, and it's good you raise it, because we've spoken a lot about compensation in the last few weeks, haven't we?
We have, yeah.
And arguably one of the things that I always find a little bit challenging around that is that a lot of the time still you get people trying to claim under misuse of private information for minor data breaches. Now, misuse of private information, I believe, originally comes out of Campbell as a tortious action. So it's interesting to see that development. And I mean, really, it's obviously not going to be directly applicable, and I don't think it's going to impact, anything from that perspective, especially in the wake of Lloyd v. Google. But yeah, no, I did see that. And yeah, as you say, very much just that trade off between what is in the public's interest.
Just remind me about the Black Spider letters. The Black Spider letters, Prince Charles's letters, weren't they? Was that a Freedom of Information request, Black Spider letters? Wasn't it? Not a Data Protection request.
I think it was a FOIA.
I'm just thinking that Meghan now is presumably, maybe she's not part of the royal family, and maybe that would extend to her, or maybe if they've relinquished that, I don't know.
No idea, in all honesty.
Anyway, you see my brain.
But it'll certainly develop the laws around privacy further when you look at the implications with Campbell, and looking at the fact that regardless of the fact that whether you're a high-profile individual or not and that kind of thing, it doesn't necessarily mean you've got lesser of a right to privacy just because you're a high-ranking individual in society. You've still got rights to privacy. Yeah. There was this kind of play-up, wasn't it, between these letters to a father that actually was somewhere arguing, or the newspapers were arguing, well, they've got to be published anyway at some point. That's the whole idea about kind of feathering your own kind of publicity stunt in that kind of sense. But the court didn't say that way on this occasion. They kind of said, shouldn't have to privacy, and if it goes public at some point in the future, that's her choice, kind of. Maybe a very summary of it.
I think they basically said that there was nothing that they had seen. Well, because I think the latest development is they tried to put it to appeal, right?
Probably going to go to the Supreme Court.
Yeah, so they tried to appeal it, but I think the appeal's been denied. I think that's what's come out. Because they're saying that there's nothing in there to suggest that those letters were of any interest to anyone in particular, from a public interest, when we say public interest, almost more like that lawful basis of, you know, broad societal aims. There's nothing in there, and it was all of a highly personal nature. So I think it is a good and welcome development. It's always good to see that doctrine strengthened. The other thing that we had actually on the plan for the session is talking about this breach that the government have been fined for, and I keep referring to it as the Home Office, but it's not the Home Office, is it?
Yeah, the Cabinet Office. That's the £1 fine. Yeah, it's for the new honours, New Year's honours list in 2019, and a failure to take appropriate technical and organisational measures to prevent the New Year's honours list concerning details of or disclosing postal addresses of individuals. Now, what I found quite interesting when you actually read through the ICO's report on that is that breaches are too easily assigned to human error, where a greater consistency of process controls and culture would have reduced risk systematically. So that started to get me thinking about how many other organisations, how many of our clients, and how easy for us to sometimes think, well, these things are just human error. This has occurred at human error without necessarily kind of thinking, well, before we kind of assign it to the human error room, how many times do we look at ourselves and think, well, is it a process? Do we need to change process? Is it training? Is it awareness? Is it the people? Is there some internal and external environmental factors that may impact it, as opposed to kind of just, well, it's a... It's a human error, isn't it? That kind of, and I think it's too easy to cast stuff off as human error without investigating further.
Well, it's interesting you should mention that, because I had a call from one of our clients this week who was asking me about, well, was asking for my opinion on whether they should proactively report themselves to the ICO about something, which is always an interesting conversation to have. Whether you know, if you've had a breach and you're considering whether it might be, you know, worthwhile giving the ICO a shout, even if you're not required to. I always find that an interesting conversation in terms of the sort of the risk benefit analysis behind that. But that's by the by. The reason I raise it is because actually they had repeated breaches. I don't want to say too much because I obviously don't want to give away anything about the client, but they'd had repeated breaches in relation to one of their key services. And it was down to human error. But having said that, it's a human error, which is kind of what you're saying, in that it was human error, but really the controls around it, the controls around the process which were affected were maybe insufficient, some might say. I mean, basically part of what they did was, as part of sending out some quite sensitive information to their clients, they would basically just drag and drop documents into shared folders, and then have a shared folder for each client and all in one place. Now, obviously it's pretty easy to, you know, drop it a little bit lower than you'd intended to and drop it into someone else's file. But then you sort of say, well, is that human error, or is that a process which by its very nature is sort of destined to be problematic ultimately? It is interesting. I mean, but at the same time, you know, what do you do about that? Do you have to then overhaul your entire process? Is it something that you can fix? If it is a risk, but that risk hasn't materialized, how do we deal with that? I don't necessarily have the answers, but you know.
No, for sure. And I think it opens up a whole range of different questions afterwards, because if it's human error, but it's repeated human error by one individual or by a range of individuals, well, what do you do when you start trend spotting? Trend spotting. What do you do when you start seeing trends regularly appearing? So we're regularly getting communications going to external from the organisation, and that's breaching confidentiality, or we've got a regular issue happening somewhere. At what point does the organisation review that, notice these trends are occurring, and then start thinking about, well, do we need to do awareness programs? Do we need to put a team through or an individual through additional training to raise that awareness? Do we need to look at the systems which you're talking about, and other processes that we've got in place? Is the risk mitigatable? Is the risk accepted? In that sense, we'll just take the risk that it offers and then we'll just continue anyway. But I think it's quite a valid point just to kind of go through, is it human error, or is it structure? Is it the fact we haven't got change control in place? Is it the fact that we've not got things documented and things are getting a little bit too loose? Is it because it's too easy to share? Is it technology is making it really simple nowadays for people to get things wrong, because we do it kind of like muscle memory, so you never not really thinking in that sense. And I think it opens up a whole host of different bits that we can start contemplating as a result before we just cast it down the lines of saying it's human error.
Well, it's Christine, I think. Sorry, I haven't got your first name, but I think it's Christine. Asks where Outlook autocomplete sits within what we're saying, which is a very good question. because it's surely one of the number one causes of data breaches that we see is autocomplete, and I've sent it to the wrong person by accident, has to be basically the most common. And the simple answer is turn it off. Sure. But then people go, oh, but I need it on.
You do get problems. I've worked with in organisations where they've turned it off, and it's a bit of a pain, but you get used to it. Like most things, eventually it just becomes just kind of the way that you do stuff. So you maybe get a little bit of pain, but you do get longer term benefits of it. But it does highlight, I think it's a really good question, because again, it highlights, if you're saying it's human error, then you say, well, it's human. Is it the human error? Is it the human that actually hit the send button that caused the problem, or the human that sits behind the IT setup that said we should have turned this thing off, we should have implemented DLP, and we haven't, we've got it available to us, and that kind of thing. So if it is human error, which human's error is it? An interesting concept.
It is an interesting concept. But, you know, I mean, ultimately, we see a huge amount of this, and you're right, people do just get used to it if you make that sort of change. It's that the one that always comes to me when I think about this sort of thing is retention. And I often get clients saying, well, how do we actually enforce good email retention across the business? And ultimately, you know, you say to them, well, you just implement a default auto archive or auto deletion and set it to, I don't know, a year or whatever you want to set it to. So I say, well, oh, no, we couldn't possibly do that. People keep stuff in their emails. No. And systematically, when I see it implemented, people might moan initially, but they just get on with it. And, you know, I'm not saying it necessarily solves the problem, because it's something that we do often talk about, that, you know, those systems, those controls might just shift the problem somewhere else.
Yeah, I was just going to pick up on that. We're looking at doing risk assessments and putting risk mitigations in place. How many people actually risk assess the mitigation? So the mitigation is, well, we'll switch the emails down to only 12 months, so nothing's going to be returning emails outside of 12 months. Well, the risk that might create is individuals then move their inbox, or what they want to save from their Outlook folder, for example, or Outlook server, to a personal file drive that they've got available to them, and save all the information there. So in essence, you've just moved it. So I think it's really valid what you said, but I think we just need to make sure that by mitigating one risk, we're not creating another in that sense. We should be mindful of maybe just having that thought process, just going on a step for some individuals.
For sure. For sure. And do feel free to keep the questions and you know, contributions coming in. Part of the reason I've got my phone here in front of me and I keep glancing at it is because that's how I'm keeping on top of the chat. So
I think you're doing a sterling job. When Phil and I was on last week, we got to the end of the session and I realised I could actually look at the chat. So Phil was doing a good standing job, but you're doing a sterling job, don't
you? Okay. Okay, right. So there's a couple of other bits that we had to cover off. I mean, we at some point need you to get on your soapbox about something, because that's our new feature. But I hear that for once, you might not actually have anything to rant about.
I think it's getting too close to Christmas to rant about too much. I can drum up. I can go back to.
Oh, I'm sure you can.
I can soon whip out my soapbox. I've actually brought a hat along with me today. I didn't know whether I should actually wear my hats. So if you give me a second to jump off screen, I've got a very festive hat I can wear in place of my soapbox for this week, if you like.
Well, I'd tell you what, it's a bit of a shame you've not got it. I'm not going to allow you to run off, because I suspect that you won't come back.
It's literally over there.
Oh, is it?
Look
at this frivolity.
There we go.
A couple of weeks till Christmas and it's all gone downhill.
I can't see your video stream.
I don't know why that is, Phil. We can see you. There he is, bar humbug.
I can't hear.
You can't hear. Excellent.
There we go.
Look at that.
Have to do it that way instead. Can we all see it? Look.
There he is.
Little bar on book hat.
That's the thumbnail for the podcast, I think, this week. At least we've got that out of the way. I've got a question in the chat from, apologies, I don't have a name against it. It's showing an unknown user.
Rosie.
Oh, is it from Rosie? I do apologise for some reason it's coming through. Rosie asks, if you have the time, could you touch on the ICO response to the DCMS consultation? Would be interested in your opinion on whether the government will take on board any of their concerns. I think we briefly spoke about this when it first came out, if memory serves. Just so we're all in alignment, effectively, that DCMS consultation paper, I think at this point we're all aware of it. Plan reforms for data protection regime. Sorry, I'm really trying to take you seriously with that.
Is it better if I take it off you?
I'll manage, I'm sure. So the DCMS consultation paper, a bunch of proposed reforms to the data protection regime in this country. Post-Brexit, the shackles are off. We can do whatever we want with our data protection laws. Some of it quite sensible, some of it less so. And the ICO did eventually provide a response to it, which, as far as I can remember, and I'm happy to be challenged on this by either yourself, Dave, or Phil, the ICO response seemed to very much mirror our own in the sense that they were saying, we're very in favor of some of these things. Some of them are very sensible. We're not against, you know, innovating and pushing for the boundaries. However, you know, you have to think about these things carefully. You can't just jump in head first. You can't just say, well, it's Brexit, so we're going to get rid of, we're going to start diluting all the rules. And I think that was broadly their response. I don't know if either of you two remember it in slightly greater detail than I
do. I do remember there's also, I don't know if you've read the ICO's Elizabeth Denham's kind of final kind of statement before she leaves office.
Mm.
And in there, she's kind of saying the same thing, maybe not the same in depth as the for the DCMS, but she did express concerns at potential direction of which things are going.
Yes.
The benefits that the GDPR has brought, the different the difference in the standards and bits, and maybe detracting too much from that. And that was in a final report. So I would agree. I think there's I'm actually in favour for it. I actually think I'm not saying it's perfect. So I'm certainly not saying that it's ideal in every aspect. But I certainly think it's not a bad bit of legislation to work with. And I think the government's advisors maybe got some parts of it right. I think some advisors that I don't know maybe potentially are paid less. There's some areas that really don't reflect my interpretation of the law. Because I don't find necessarily the GDPR as being as that problematic as what the government seems to think.
No, well, I think that was one of the big problems with it, as far as I was concerned, particularly, is there was some language at points in that consultation paper. Not that I read all of it, I just want to make that clear. I flicked through it, but at points there was some language which was quite reminiscent of that Tiger report, which. It's sort of that headline grabbing, oh, aren't cookies a nightmare? Why did the GDPR impose cookie banners on us? You sort of go, oh, okay, right, so this is the source that we're dealing with. Some of it was properly researched and some of it did make a lot of sense, but at points it did feel like, I don't know, maybe it was just attempting to be headline grabbing. So, you know, I do generally back what the ICO has said on this.
I know it's a slightly off now, but do you think that headline grabbing's more the era of politics that we seem to be in at the moment?
Well, yeah, quite possibly.
As opposed to any real substance.
Quite possibly. Peter makes a good point. It says that Elizabeth Denham was also worried about the independence of the ICO, and that's quite right. One of the reforms proposed as part of this DCMS consultation paper was effectively weakening the ICO a little bit on a number of fronts, giving them less independence. I think there were things to do with how. So first of all, they wanted to do away with the position of commissioner, didn't they? They wanted to instead replace it with
like a chair, or
something. Yeah, a chair. And I think the appointment of those individuals would be more controlled by the government, I think. I might be wrong on that front.
Yeah, I think they need to stay independent. And personally, the only criticism of the ICO I would have, and it's not a heavy criticism, I just wish they'd use some of the powers a bit more. And I don't necessarily think finding people, I don't necessarily think fines are all the right in every aspect. I just think if you've had a breach and they have a look at your action plan, and instead of kind of going, yeah, well, all right, fair enough, we've seen what you've done, that's fine. I would like them to say, kind of, let's have a look at your action plan and can you demonstrate that you're proactively working your way through within 3 months and completed within six, and show evidence that it's completed within six, to show that they're taking it seriously, as opposed to just some general acceptance that, well, all right, you've got a plan in place, but not actually enforcing the delivery of that plan.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. Peter correct says apparently it'd be a CEO in the head of the Information Commissioner's office. I see also, Phil, that you've popped a link in there. You've been awfully quiet.
I'm not getting a word in edgeways. I put two links in there, two quite, I think, good summaries. One Lexology, one Panopticon, of the ICO's response. You know, basically, you're saying they're supportive of this and they're disagreeing with that, and they're strongly disagreeing with the reformation of the the ICO, the Secretary of State appointing the chief executive in a revised regulatory structure. So it's quite, both of them take a slightly different perspective, but they're quite good summaries. I mean, it's quite a long response, which I think is good, you know, but what was Rose's original question? What we thought might happen? Just, I mean, who knows, you know, we've talked about happening is a change of government and it never come into fruition. But maybe we should layer over that what Dave Hendry found on LinkedIn, the fount of all.
So have you had a chance to read that? Because Dave and I sort of looked at each other before we went live and went, oh, none of us have actually read it.
Yeah, I have read it, yeah. And it's a bit of an interesting one. So here's the link to it. Just pop it in the chat here. Because interesting is it's this kind of top EU official who actually turns out to be the European Data Protection Supervisor. And as we know, the Data Protection Supervisor is only, their jurisdiction is European institutions, isn't it? So, And what they're basically saying is that they think there's a need across Europe to have a more centralised approach to enforcement. But it's unclear whether that's across EU institutions or whether that's across, you know, EU countries, territories. Anyway, they're just floating the idea out of reforming the GDPR in order to kind of build, I think, to build into it this centralised enforcement. So but it seems that everybody else is pushing back, saying, hang on a minute, you know, it's actually doing OK. The Australian... previous regulator said, well, you know, in the last 3.5 years, we think we've done quite well with the GDPR. It doesn't need reforming, so let's just leave it as it is and see how it pans out. But I mean, there could be internal European politics at work here, but it doesn't necessarily mean that those types of things would affect us, because if it's centralised enforcement across the EU, then, you know, we're no longer in the EU, are we?
Do you think it's more a political thing about greater integration across Europe? In that sense, as opposed to necessarily anything other than...
Well, it could be.
Centralised enforcement would be fine, but you still have to take effect of national laws, I would have thought. That might have an impact on how decisions are formed.
Yeah, I mean, this article is citing the Irish Data Protection Commission slowness in enforcement. But, you know, and again, that could be for political reasons rather than anything else, couldn't it? You know, why would you want to upset all the big tech that's in Ireland? I mean, there's probably quite a few different things. But as we're talking about reformation or potential reformation of the British data protection laws, I thought it might be just chucking in this.
Definitely worth chucking. I think Rose's initial question was... about whether we think the government will actually take on board what the ICO has said. And actually, I think that sort of ties into quite an interesting proposition, which I think you initially put to us, Dave, which was that obviously that consultation paper was the brainchild of that particular department, and particularly Oliver Dowden, who was pretty, you know, aggressive in pushing for reform on a lot of these things, I think we can say. And now, obviously, there's been a reshuffle. So it's no longer him. It's now Nadine Dorries, isn't it, in charge of DCMS. So is she going to pick this up and run with it? And then what happens if we have a complete change of government? Are they just going to drop it?
I don't know. For sure, because they're on about reshuffles and things in politics, because they're probably trying to prepare for a general election in about 18 months.
Yeah,
2 years max. So then you're looking at, if they're going to make any changes, have they got parliamentary time to discuss it and to kind of go through the process of doing all of that and that kind of stuff? If there's a change of government, so the Conservatives get booted out, and whoever gets voted in that place, will they still kind of think, well, we need to detract? If you have a party that's more aligned to staying as closely aligned to the EU as you can, they may think, actually, we're just going to leave it well alone. We don't want to touch it.
No, for sure.
In that sense. So some of it, I think, will be a timing issue. It'll be interesting to see which way the government goes. They've done so many U-turns on so many other things. I wouldn't be surprised if they turn around and back on themselves before they get to a decision.
Here he is. It's time for Dave Soapbox.
I'm Holly. Just a quick one. I don't know, because last week we had a question from somebody about a charity, didn't we, taking over some work with a council. And I don't know if we've got time. We should be talking about that. I don't know if the person who sent it in is on the session. But have you read the background?
We can do. I was just going to say, finally, before we close on that previous topic, that Emma's saying that She's seen concerns that any watering down of the independence of the ICO may also impact on our adequacy decision, which, yeah, it sort of all ties in, doesn't it, ultimately, yeah. Which I think is probably fair enough. Yeah, we did have a question in from a listener. I unfortunately don't have it in front of me, so I can't read
it. I have it here. If I share my screen, if I share my whole screen, you'll see.
Yes. I don't know if Tom's on, actually. I think it was from Tom. Oh my God.
Can you read my screen? I'm trying to...
Well, we're sat a little bit away from the laptop. We can't really feel, so you'll just have to guide us through.
No, he says, we've taken over a contract that another charity had with the council. Under this contract, we provide individuals with basic support, i.e., or e.g., reminding them to pay their bills so they can continue to live independently for as long as possible. Now, the other charity had told me that they were a controller of the data and the council was only a sponsor. I'm not entirely sure what a sponsor is. But as it turns out, they weren't the controller, i.e. the charity. The council is the controller. It says not controllers in common either. The charity is a processor. It says, however, before the contract was transferred to us, your other charity had all the service users sign new forms consenting us to process the data, which... which is a bit messy. You're too right, it's a bit messy. One, I'm not convinced that consent would be the most appropriate lawful basis. This says it would have gone for contracts. I'm not sure it would have gone for contracts. And perhaps with consent as an Article 9 condition with respect to category data, again, I'm not sure I'd go for consent there either. Surely it's inappropriate the consent has been given to a processor with the controller not even mentioned. Absolutely spot on. So primarily this is, of course, a council's problem because the charity is only a processor and they only follow orders. But since we only just got the contract, I don't want to tell, you know, saying I don't want to tell them that this is a problem before I feel sure about it. Yeah, it's a good shout. So in essence, there's a charity providing services to a council's data subjects, sending out reminders, you know, to have to pay their bills so they can remain living independent, which sounds like it's a bit of a safeguarding issue, really, to some extent. So that's it. So the council is clearly, if the council is demonstrably the controller, and it doesn't matter what the contract says, it's who's actually determining the means and the purposes of the processing, isn't it? That's the acid testing.
Yeah.
And if the charity is simply a processor, then, you know, they should have a contract and they should have instructions, and it's the controller's responsibility to ensure that they have privacy information, and, you know, they may very well name the charity as a recipient, but I wouldn't have gone for consent, because it's, you know, if people don't give consent or withdraw their consent, then that means they're not supported, which, if it is a really, you know, a thing that's important to them and in the public interest, then
would you not be doing it under performance for public task or a public interest if you're even if you're a private sector?
Well, I would have said
body,
so, yeah.
But
yeah,
you're operating on behalf of the council.
Yeah. I would have said it's a public a task carried out in the public interest or under official authority, which is the lawful basis that many public authorities use, and the processor doesn't need. You know, effectively, they piggyback on the lawful basis of the controller, don't they? Just get told what to do. But if they were processing any special category data, again, that doesn't sound like it's an explicit consent thing. Again, that sounds far too complicated, because if there's multiple types of special category data, then, well, different purposes, then you might have a really complicated set of consents you're collecting.
For sure.
Which, again, you know, I'm stereotyping, maybe to come conclusions here, but, you know, some of these data subjects might not be able to, you know, work with that kind of complexity, you know, or understand it.
No, I think that's reasonable. I think using consent in any instance where you are dealing with people who are vulnerable is, I automatically think that is a bit...
It's a bad idea, isn't it?
Just a bad idea, because... Because, I mean, arguably, obviously, as we all know, one of the key requirements of consent is freely given, right? And that is, you know, I think that freely given element goes much further than just not tying it into a contract. Instances, well, we already know that the imbalance of power between staff and their employers, someone literally just pointing that out now, the imbalance of power idea is not appropriate. But I think even in instances where, you know, you're the local authority supporting vulnerable people, whether that's the elderly, whether it's people potentially with certain disabilities, or it could be anything. Quite
if it's an individual, let's say it's an individual learning difficulty,
yeah, exactly,
for whatever reason, then they might not have the capacity to give valid consent because they don't understand what they're consenting to, or yeah, the ability to understand what it means by giving consent and for somebody to do something with their information. So I would have understood it's consent can be very problematic.
For sure. And I'd go beyond that in that, you know, even sort of ignoring for a second the capacity issue. You know, if you've got people who are in a more desperate situation, they're obviously going to agree if you ask them for something. So I just feel uncomfortable, I think, is the way to phrase it.
Possibly whether it's sorry for London to cover it, but possibly even if it's in their best interests to do it, then again there may be a course of action that you need to take. Even if an individual say no, I don't consent to it.
No,
you're
thinking,
well, actually there's a welfare issue, there's a and that kind of stuff, and safeguarding issue and things. So it's a consent doesn't work in every instance. Yeah. Sorry, Phil.
Well, I was going to say that it potentially could be. I mean, that Lars' point is, aren't we anyway speaking about special capacity? We probably are, Lars, but not exclusively, not necessarily. You know, reminding them to pay their bills. I'm not sure without knowing the specifics of it. So you know, we mentioned, you know, the interest, legitimate interest, presumably of the data subject. Or you know, their housing provider. So there's probably, certainly I would not be going to consent. But what would you do as a processor? Would you be raising this with the controller? I think that I would be if I was a processor.
Well, I think what's interesting about that is there is something that I've come across before, and I know that you've got a little bit of a bee in your bonnet about this, Phil, potentially, because you've raised it with me
so
before.
I'm passing over the so-called bill. Can I stand up it for today?
Yeah, which is that under Article 28, there is a requirement on the processor to inform the controller if any of their instructions in relation to auditing them, I think, infringe the regulation. Yeah. Is that right?
Absolutely, and it's totally misunderstood in many cases.
That is misunderstood because it's often written in as any infringement of the GDPR must be notified. But that's quite an interesting scenario, because if you had that in your contract, regardless of whether that's what it's supposed to say, and you've got an instance where you think the consent is invalid, then contractually you'd be obliged to notify that, wouldn't you?
Well, you
whatever
would.
That's worth.
Yeah, you would. Yeah, it's. I mean, it's interesting because it's at the bottom of Article 20, and it's a kind of a second paragraph, isn't it? It must be Article 28, three, and then it's after the last point H. And but it says, with regard to point H of paragraph one, the processor immediately informs the controller if, in its opinion, an instruction infringes the regulation. Blah 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 blah. But that's specifically in relation to H, which is all about audits, inspections, and so on and so forth. I.e., if you go on site and conduct an audit and you're exposed to information you don't feel you should be, you know, this is probably not a very good example, then you should be saying to the controller, oh, we shouldn't be seeing that type of thing, but not any instruction infringing the regulation, which is how a lot of people read it, probably because it's a separate paragraph, but it certainly says with regard to point H.
Can you tell that Phil's picked me up on that before? But I've learned. Christine saying in relation to the consent issue that it's similar to the commitment to refer in relation to housing. I'll be honest, that doesn't mean anything to me. That doesn't speak to me. Commitment to refer.
A referral to other agencies, I think that probably means, you know.
Oh, I see.
Probably. But if Christine wants to just unmute, you're more than welcome to join in. Anybody is. If you want to just unmute and muscle your way in, you're more than welcome.
It's hard to get a word in. As I'm not in the room with you, I'm finding it hard to get a word in.
Yes, within housing is a discussion that I've had quite often about, you know, people in capacity and do if they decide that they're going to go away on holiday and spend all their rent on a holiday rather than actually paying their rent, and at which point we're at a point where we're threatening to seek repossession and make them homeless. There's always that imbalance, I think, with making sure that we've done everything that we can to support them to sustain their tenancy, and allowing them to make bad decisions for themselves, going down the whole capacity route. And I think there's always a bit of a dilemma as to whether or not you can send a referral to a local authority to say, look, this person's at risk of losing their home because they haven't paid their rent. against the Homelessness Act and that sort of thing. So it's a case of, when can you tell people, should you be passing that data on? At what point are you breaching their rights and freedoms by sharing? I think
there's actually, sorry to cross, Chrissy, I think there's actually, in the, correct me if I'm wrong as well, fellow Nolly, but I thought there's a safeguarding for economic reasons the schedule. So if it would fall within that, then it would potentially be able to...
Yeah, if I may, because I've spent quite a lot of time working on this for a housing client in the past. It's tricky because you're right, there's the safeguarding individuals at economic risk, but there's also safeguarding in children and individuals at risk generally, I think.
Yes, there is.
And the problem, if you call it a problem, the issue with those two conditions, first of all, they apply to special category data, they're substantial public interest conditions. But the issue with them is that you have to demonstrate that you cannot get consent for whatever reason it is. So either consent is not available, it would prejudice your operation to get consent, whatever that might be. And actually that really throws a bit of a spanner into the works, because demonstrating that you cannot get consent is actually relatively difficult, particularly in the scenario that Christine depicts, because you have instances where you might have tenants engage with you proactively as part of a tenancy sustainability or a welfare benefit team. They might engage with you proactively and say, yes, I consent to you, you know, making referrals, contacting the local authority, Universal Credit, whoever it might be. But you might have instances where you have genuine safeguarding concerns and either they refuse to engage, or for reasons potentially maybe linked to, I don't know, domestic violence or something, they're not able to engage. So what do you do then? So you do have that condition that you can rely on, but it does mean that you all are almost strong-armed into defaulting to consent for everything else, mm-hmm. because you have to prove that you couldn't get consent. It's a bit of a catch-22, and it's a bit of a, again, it sort of, you know, harks back to what I was saying before, it feels a bit uncomfortable asking people who are vulnerable for consent, but you kind of between a rock and a hard place with it, really.
But if the Homelessness Reduction Act 2017 is putting a legal obligation on the local housing authority and the charity is providing this service on behalf of the local authority, isn't that then also a legal obligation to share the data for the charity? Or at least share it with the local authority to share, to then fulfill their legal obligation?
Yeah, quite possibly in that case. You're right. In the case that I worked on, we didn't have anything. It was just broader than purely reducing homelessness. So it was all to do with, you know, any sort of safeguarding concern, which is where the complication comes in. But you're right, in the particular context at hand, I'd have to check on the Homelessness Reduction Act, I think it's called. Is it? Because, you know, I don't know what it contains, quite frankly. But yeah, in theory, it seems reasonable to assume that if there's a statutory provision that you can rely on legal obligation. Although I will say, and this might not be the case necessarily here, but I'm sure you will have seen this before, and I'm sure everyone else on the call will have come across this, but you do find instances where people say, well, organisations, not people, you know, that we've got a statutory obligation to collect this information. It is the whatever act. And you sort of say, hang on a second, you have got statutory obligations under this piece of legislation, but nowhere in there does it say you actually have to collect any of this information. You know, you'll have things like a very broad requirement under a particular statute, and they say, yes, under that, for this very specific reason, we collect these very specific, you know, pieces of information. Well, no, you have to point in the law where it says, actually, you know, you have an obligation to undertake this. I don't know.
Yeah, I sometimes found that, because I always like to go back to the law that they're quoting, because I often find it's misquoted anyway.
Yeah.
So you get people, we're having to click this because of this bit of the law, and you go and have a look, and you kind of go, but that, if you actually read the section around the law, that bit really doesn't catch you. So like I said, normally I like people quoting the law just to give me a chance to go and actually read it and see whether they're interpreting it properly. Some do. I'm certainly not suggesting everybody misinterprets, but I've had it misinterpreted. Even using completely wrong bits of law in that sense. So it's always useful just to go and check.
Yeah, it is difficult, because ultimately, and this is one of the things that we often come back to, is that reading the law and certain pieces of statute in particular is not it's not easy. You know, it's something that, you know, you have to have a certain degree of, well, training effectively and education, you know, possibly to be able to read the law in an effective and efficient way.
I think you're being too generous. I think even with a lot of education and training, trying to read the law is still
difficult. Well, the Data Protection Act in particular, yeah. But my point being that, you know, the requirements for a DPO or a data protection lead, governance lead, whoever it might be, are, you know, relatively loose, but actually you do need someone in there who can tackle statute and who is able and confident to go away and read a piece of the law. I remember when we were talking about handling COVID information a while back, you went and dug around in the Coronavirus Act, is it?
Yes, I was, yeah.
Yeah, I remember you sending me that, and that was riveting. But you have to be able to do it. I feel like you've not been able to get a word in edgeways again, Phil. Is there anything you wanted to chip in on this?
No, nothing.
Just no. Happy to be involved. Well, I tell you what, we really, really outdone ourselves this time. We've got 2 minutes of this session left, technically, although we did start a little bit late. So if anyone wants to stick around for a few minutes after 5:30, then you're more than welcome to.
I'm going
to
bail out at 5:30 so I can hit the road and get down to the Christmas party. What did you read ICO's opinion on the ad tech? So do you remember in last year, year before, 2019, was it? They issued an opinion on ad tech. And now they're saying there's a lot of work going on, but they're just wanting to reiterate certain principles, and they've published a new opinion last week.
I read the first part of that. Some of it's pretty obvious, though. It's all kind of privacy by design. It had in there for online advertising. The proposal should also offer choice, so without tracking, profiling, or targeting. Transparency is back in there, understanding how and why processing is fair and lawful, and identify privacy risks and mitigate them. And there's probably more going to fall out of it, but that's the bit that I kind of read initially. I thought, well, it still seemed pretty obvious stuff. I maybe skipped over some of the technical bits, but if you're going to challenge me on any of that, but that's a really loose kind of reading of it this morning.
No, I wasn't going to challenge on any of that. I was, again, interested. It builds itself as saying that it's going to, show ways, and require the ad tech to demonstrate compliance. I was expecting it to be much more explicit and prescriptive about, and you've got to be able to do this because you need to demonstrate compliance. But I don't think it goes far enough at this point. One of the interesting things was it talking about the proportionality, fairness and necessity of online tracking and profiling. Again, that's interesting. Mm. What they're not saying is we don't think it can be done. And a lot of the opinion is saying, you know, you can do this stuff. You just got to do it in the right way, which I thought was quite a pragmatic approach personally. There's a lot moved on. Like cookies here, that, you know, it looks like third party cookies are getting, you know, phased out and anyway by the movers and shakers, and browsers are getting better. And this, you mentioned it before, haven't you? The Apple ad tracking and the Google the GPS, the privacy center, is it? I can't remember what the GPS slipped my mind what it is, but it was quite an interesting interim kind of publication that the ICO has pushed out. When does John Edwards come into post? Is he
January? I think.
Hey?
Yeah, early January. I think he still wants Christmas on the beach before he comes over to the UK shores.
We thought we might check with you, our John Edwards correspondent.
I'll have Christmas on the beach as well, if I could.
Yeah, you and me both. Okay, well, I tell you what, we're winding down now. We've run out of time. I mean, I say if you want to get off, Phil, then by all means. Dave, I assume you and I would like to sit on for another couple of minutes if anyone's got any particular questions they want to raise, anything particular.
If anybody's got any technical questions on how to set up sound systems, we're not bringing Miles.
But it looks very impressive. I am going to hit the road, so it's lovely to see everybody, and I look forward to seeing you both in person in an hour and a half when I get down to the office.
Excellent. Well, we shall see you very soon, Phil. Thank you, Phil. I think he's gone.
Yeah, no, thanks, Phil. We'll see you shortly.
Yeah. Well, let's close out the session then, unless anyone's got anything else they wanted to raise. I can see people starting to filter out. So let's wrap up, I think. So thank you all very much for attending. We hope that was of some interest or value.
Oliver, oh, yes. I've got a question, mate.
Yes.
What have you got for Secret Santa?
None of your business. What wonder who that was then. I didn't recognise you.
I can ask another question. Who's going to still be in the office for when Phil gets here?
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. I seem to be the only person in this office who's actually managed to keep their Secret Santa secret. So, no, I'm going to keep my cards close to my chest. Anyway, on that note, let's bring it all to a close. So thank you all very much for attending. As I say, hopefully that was of some interest or value to you all. Thank you very much to Phil Brining, who's had to jump off. Thank you very much, Dave, for coming down, or coming up, I suppose. All the way from Essex to come and see us.
I might still bring out the hat next week. I might not, but it'll then go back in the box for another year.
I can't say I'll be sad to see the back of it. It's been really quite disconcerting. So thank you to everyone on the session. We're back next week actually with a bumper event. I think it's our Temmie's very first event that she's put together. We're very excited about that. It's primarily focused on the healthcare sector and in particular data sharing, but generally about the healthcare sector. So if you're in healthcare, do come along. Even if you're not, it might still be interesting. You never know.
Just correct me, have we got three guest speakers?
Yes, we have. We've got three very special guest speakers. Sorry, I keep looking at Miles at the end. We've got three very special guest speakers. We're very excited to have them on. More details to come in the week. If you want an invitation, as ever, just get in touch with Miles primarily, or any of us for that matter. So yeah, we hope to see you for that one. I'd like also just to say, well done, Miles, for organising all of this. Thank you for facilitating all of this. A quick thank you to our friends at Trio Media as well for lending us their nice, shiny kit. Bubble Digital, are they now? Okay. So thank you to them for lending us this nice, shiny kit. Hopefully this has persuaded Dave Hendry to buy us one that we can have a play with. But otherwise, thank you, Dave.
No, thank you very much. Thank you, everybody. Have a great weekend, and we'll hopefully catch you next week.
Absolutely. See you all soon.
Check out now. Bye-bye.